From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, the game of dueling secretaries between Donald Rumsfeld's pugnacious Pentagon and Colin Powell's diplomatic State Department went code red last week with Rumsfeld pal Newt Gingrich's startling public condemnation of the Powell record. Rumsfeld and the neocons are crowing atop an Iraqi victory. Powell sits atop a United Nations failure and an embattled worldview. Tonight on Point, Colin Powell and the deepening rift at the core of the Bush administration. Should Colin Powell resign? We begin in Jerusalem, where Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and newly elected Palestinian Premier Mahmoud Abbas were today presented with the so-called roadmap to a two-state peace between Israel and the Palestinians. The plan, drawn up by Washington, the EU, the UN, and Russia, is to be given a new push with Abbas in office and the Iraq war over. Earlier, I spoke with David Horowitz, editor of the Jerusalem Report. I asked him how the roadmap is being received in Israel today.
I think much to do about nothing would be the way to respond to that. It was the fourth item on the news late this afternoon after details of strikes and, of course, the latest victims of the suicide bombing. I think there's, at the very best, a kind of wary optimism that perhaps the elevation of Abu Mazen to Palestinian Prime Minister and the presentation of this roadmap might yield change, but nothing more than that. There's a great desire among ordinary Israelis, for sure, and also their government, it tells them, for a change on the ground, for Abu Mazen to depart from what most Israelis believe Arafat has been doing, which is actually orchestrating terrorism, and instead to thwart terrorism. If that happens, then I think one can start to talk about something really having changed.
If the response in Israel is so underwhelming, how does that augur for the prospects for something, for anything, coming out of the roadmap?
It emphasizes that as far as Israel is concerned, and when I say Israel, I don't just mean the government. I mean three-quarters probably of Israelis believe that there's nothing more that they can do. They had a previous government that went to Camp David and tried to make peace. As far as they're concerned, Yasser Arafat rejected terms and demanded terms that would effectively end Israel as a Jewish state. And therefore, the consensus in Israel is, well, if the Palestinians are really changing now, if they're going to start educating their people to the fact of Israel's right to exist, if they're going to stop broadcasting inflammatory sermons from mosques on their TV, and most importantly, if they're going to arrest the bombers, then great. But unless that happens, this is, you know, well-intentioned outside intervention and some nice rhetoric, but really waiting for the change on the ground.
It sounds like a very long way from that perspective to a Palestinian state in the year 2005, which the roadmap foresees.
Yes, but it need not be. You see, now you get into sort of the internal Israeli argument about what happens if there is progress on the ground. You have to remember that it was only, 4 years ago that 56% of Israelis voted for Ehud Barak as prime minister, effectively endorsing a platform that said, yes, the Palestinians should have a state alongside Israel, and Israel should really make whatever compromise it can, short of national suicide, to achieve a two-state fair solution. That was something that most Israelis were effectively signing on to just a few years ago. They are now so disillusioned with most especially Yasser Arafat, but everyone who has sustained him in power. They believe that he's a terrorist, and they can't understand why much of the world took so long to see this. They're relieved that sort of as of a year ago that the Bush administration has basically signed on to that mindset. But they believe that if Arafat is still there, if he's behind the scenes really calling the shots, even with Abu Mazen as prime minister, then this shift means nothing and this roadmap will go nowhere. But if, on the other hand, Abu Mazen, having taken office, having overwhelmed Arafat's objection to the man he's put in as his Minister of Security Affairs, Mohammed Dahlan, whose job will be to take on the bombers, if this is significant, if there is real change, if Arafat becomes a marginal symbolic figure who doesn't set the tone, then there's no reason, I would say, why most Israelis could not find themselves comfortably contemplating coexistence with the Palestinians. But it has to be in a very different climate from that prevails today.
The election and empowerment of Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen, as he's widely known, was a prerequisite, at least in Washington, for releasing the roadmap, for saying, let's go with it. His very first statement before the Palestinian electoral body there was very anti-terrorism, or at least included remarks to that effect. What will the concrete evidence that he needs to demonstrate be for Israeli people, for the Israeli government?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. His speech was conciliatory. His speech was a clear call for an end to terrorism, for an end to the armed intifada, which he has opposed rather quietly for the first 2 years and in the last 6 months rather more stridently. The test on the ground will be, well, is Hamas being thwarted? Are its leaders being arrested? Are the speakers in the mosques being given less airtime on Palestinian television? Is weaponry being collected, confiscated by a Palestinian security force that is not itself engaged in terrorism? And it's very, very complicated, this reality, that the suicide bombing last night was carried out by people who proclaimed themselves to be loyalists to Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat is much more popular than Abu Mazen among ordinary Palestinians. So Abu Mazen is coming in with good intentions, it appears, in a very, very complicated and sensitive reality. And the signs will be obvious. It will be very clear if he is able to confront these armed extremist groups, and it will be very obvious if he is not.
Can Abu Mazen satisfy both the international community and the Palestinians? And I guess, what can Israel, what can the United States do to help him satisfy both these constituencies at the same time?
Well, it sounds impossible, doesn't it? But I don't think it is. It's just that it's a process. If phase one, he takes on the bombers and they are thwarted and bombs stop going off, then the Israeli government is assuring its people and the international community it wants nothing more than to be able to ease Palestinian movement, you know, the restrictions that have prevented Palestinians traveling between cities, take down the roadblocks, bring the army back out of the West Bank cities that they've retaken.
But does he have the capacity to do that? We understand an awful lot of Palestinian police stations have been taken down by Israelis because they were said to be centers of anti-Israel sentiment, if not militant action. Does he have the capacity to confront the violent elements within the Palestinian community?
Right away, I would say the answer is almost certainly not. It's a gradual thing. And there's an Israeli spokesman who I heard earlier today who blamed Abu Mazen for the Tel Aviv suicide bombing, and I think that's absurd. If that were the line that all the Israeli officials were taking, you'd have to say they're not being remotely realistic or fair. Most of the Israeli official spokespeople have not said that. They've said it's not realistic to expect that Abu Mazen, who didn't actually formally take office until after the suicide bombing, could possibly have enough control to stop the bombers. Hamas, of course, is formally committed to the destruction of Israel. This will take time. He will have to rebuild those security services, which, as far as Israel was concerned, were corrupted by terrorism and indeed have been targeted by the Israeli army in the last 2 years or so. It is a long process. Terrorism will not come to a halt tomorrow, even if he tries to the utmost. The question is he going to make the effort? Is the Israeli army and the Israeli government going to give him room for maneuver? Will the Palestinian public give him sufficient support? These are very real questions, and they underline why anyone who is today saying, oh, there's a new Palestinian prime minister, the roadmap's been unveiled, everything's going to be wonderful, well, that's just out of touch with the reality.
David Horowitz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
David Horowitz is editor of the Jerusalem Report. He spoke with us earlier from Jerusalem.
The last 7 months have involved 6 months of diplomatic failure and 1 month of military success. Now the State Department is back at work pursuing policies that will clearly throw away all the fruits of hard-won victory.
Newt Gingrich, pal of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, lambasting Colin Powell's State Department last week in a speech at the American Enterprise Institute. When Rumsfeld held a swank Iraqi victory party on Washington's Embassy Row last week, Colin Powell was nowhere to be seen. State Department officials said that the nation's top diplomat was not invited. Behind the Beltway social snub is a profound battle over American foreign policy. Colin Powell, despite his enormous public popularity, appears to have lost. President Bush didn't stand up for Powell after Newt Gingrich thrashed his department last week, hanging Powell out to dry as he marches off to work on Middle East peace. In an historic collision of worldviews, Colin Powell has come out bloody. Is this a sustainable divide within the Bush administration? Should Colin Powell resign? Does the Secretary of State bring important moderation to the Bush team, or is he just defeated camouflage on a triumphant unilateralist agenda? And whose camp are you in? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Tom Gelton, National Security Correspondent for National Public Radio. Good evening and welcome, Tom Gelton.
Good evening, Tom. Good to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Washington tonight, E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. E.J. Dionne, good to have you back.
Good to be with you and Tom.
Yes, great. And with me tonight in the studio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here in the flesh.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest. Tom Gilton, I know we only have you for a few minutes. Dive in with us here. How deep, in your view, is how wide is this Pentagon-State Department rift? How disparate the worldviews churning out of these two great organizations?
Well, Tom, I think it's pretty significant, and it's gotten a lot deeper in the last, really in the last few weeks. We've had Donald Rumsfeld, the Defense Secretary, increasingly weighing in on foreign policy issues for the Bush administration. And this really, I mean, we've said it before that it was unprecedented the extent to which Donald Rumsfeld was getting involved in foreign policy, but he's really beaten himself in the last couple of weeks, sending memos to the administration, advising them, advising the administration on how to approach North Korea diplomacy, for example, making statements about the future of the Middle East that really preempt the prerogatives of the State Department. I think, however, that traditionally the Pentagon has a set of concerns and the State Department has a set of concerns. There's always going to be institutional friction between them. We certainly saw it in the Clinton administration. The key will be, and I think today was a very important day, the key will be where the president comes down. You mentioned before that he did not support Colin Powell when Newt Gingrich laid into him.
Not specifically, not rhetorically anyway.
Right. But now today he did roll out the roadmap for Middle East peace. This is something that Colin Powell, of course, takes very seriously. I think the key question tonight is whether President Bush is going to really commit his administration to this roadmap. If he does not, it'll be yet another slap in the face for Colin Powell. On the other hand, if he does, in fact, commit his administration to Middle East peace and to the implementation of this roadmap, that will be a big victory for Colin Powell. So maybe we're being a little bit premature in writing him off.
But Tom Gilton, what's your gut here? Is this a kind of peekaboo game with the White House where they give a nod to Colin Powell, but ultimately it's the Pentagon agenda very often that seems to prevail? Is this a real embrace? Is it a kind of camouflage? Is it a genuine kind of vacillation in the president's own worldview?
I think, Tom, it is actually some vacillation in the president's own worldview, because the Pentagon hasn't always been the winner in these, or Donald Rumsfeld has not always been the winner in these disputes. Last fall, it was Colin Powell who prevailed when he convinced the president to work through the United Nations. That was not something that even Dick Cheney, the vice president, not to mention Donald Rumsfeld, was really enthusiastic about. So there have been a few victories for Colin Powell. And another point to always keep in mind is that we talk about the Pentagon as though it were a monolith. There's actually a big split within the Pentagon itself between the civilian leadership, the half dozen or so top civilian people, and the uniformed military leadership.
And yet we know where policy seems to be made there, at least lately. Jack Beatty, where do you come down? Bottom line, and we'll talk this through tonight, but has Colin Powell sustained so much incoming, so much artillery barrage, so much indignity in some sense, should he resign? Should he go away?
Well, I don't think he should resign over past abuses, but he could resign over a future grave calamity. I mean, we know what he wants to do with North Korea. He wants to negotiate. He wants to continue with the Clinton policy. If the Bush hawks push this toward the point where there's going to be nothing, no alternative but war, well, then Powell could really do a service to the nation by resigning on principle. Then he'd be following in the footsteps of Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, who resigned over the Wilson note after the Lusitania because he thought this would drive us into war with Germany, a principled resignation.
Tom Gilton, just 20 seconds, but do you have any sense that he's actually considering such a move?
I think it would take something really dramatic for him to do that. I think the bigger question, Tom, is whether he'll be back for a second term, and my sources say that that's quite unlikely at this point. That's only a year from this fall that we'll have a new election. And
a kind of de facto resignation there. E.J. Dionne, we're going to come back and hear from you on this. Tom Gilton, I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Anytime, Tom.
Tom Gilton is national security correspondent for NPR. Listeners, we're talking tonight about Colin Powell and the deepening rift between the State Department and the Pentagon at the very heart of the Bush administration. You can join us. Is Colin Powell the problem? Is he the solution? Does he still matter? Is this a sustainable divide? Should Colin Powell resign? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about Secretary of State Colin Powell and the deepening rift between the State Department and the Pentagon at the very heart of the Bush administration. I'm joined tonight by E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, by our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. Does Colin Powell bring real moderation to the Bush team, or is he just confusing camouflage on a hawkish neoconservative agenda? Has Powell failed his own agenda? Does that mean he should go? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Last week, in front of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, Newt Gingrich, a frequent correspondent, to say the least, with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, stood up and made a really top-to-bottom scathing condemnation of Colin Powell, State Department. Let's hear a bit more of that.
These continuing failures and refusal to learn about new realities compels the Bush administration to take on transforming the State Department as its next urgent mission. It is now time for the president to call for the equivalent of a Goldwater-Nichols reform bill for the State Department and redefine peace on our terms. America cannot lead the world with a broken instrument of diplomacy. America cannot lead the world in an age of democracy and 24-hour television with a broken instrument of international communications. America cannot help develop a vibrant world of entrepreneurial progress where countries grow into safety, health, prosperity, and freedom for their people with a broken bureaucracy of red tape and excuses. The House and Senate committees on international relations should hold exhaustive hearings on the requirements of diplomatic and communications leadership in the 21st century.
Newt Gingrich, last week in Washington, laying into Colin Powell's State Department. E.J. Dionne, help us understand what we're hearing here. We know that the former Speaker of the House is long out of power, but he is reportedly not far from Don Rumsfeld's elbow. We read more than a month ago in the New York Times, Bill Keller, columnist there, saying that, you know, this is an extraordinarily capable man, such a loyal and optimistic man, he said, would make some president a great Secretary of State, just not this one. He called for Powell to resign. What's going on here? What does Gingrich's attack mean? What are the dimensions of this fundamental rift? And do you think Colin Powell will stick around? Should he stick around?
Well, listening to that speech, you feel like the headline should be Gingrich calls for regime change at State Department.
Move over, and John Kerry. The phrase has been taken again.
And that earlier soundbite you used where he talked about 6 months of diplomatic failure versus 1 month of military success, he might as well have said Rumsfeld beats Powell 7-0.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that he is seen correctly as being close to Rumsfeld, as an advisor over there at an unpaid advisor over there at the Defense Department,
mm-hmm. Defense
heightened
Policy
the
Board.
Sense that this really was a somehow connected to Donald Rumsfeld in the Rumsfeld Powell wars. Now, I do think, and I'll get to the question about, I don't think he'll quit, by the way, Powell will quit,
mm-hmm.
but I think that one of the best things that ever happened to Powell was to be attacked by Newt Gingrich. He's a lightning rod, and it sure didn't hurt Bill Clinton to be attacked by him. And it was the first time you really saw the Powell forces strike back. If you recall, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, who's very close to Powell, said, and I'm quoting him here, it's clear that Mr. Gingrich is off his meds and out of therapy.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of thing you hear much. And later, just to underscore this, Richard Boucher, the department spokesman, was asked to comment on this psychiatric report on Gingrich, and he interrupted to say, we call him Dr. Deputy Secretary Armitage.
But E.J., these guys both work for Colin Powell. Who are the Powell forces that you talk about?
Well, no, but just to go to the political fight, I think it's important that he is somehow finally striking back.
Mm-hmm.
So it does suggest some willingness to, in other words, he's not simply rolling over before this assault, and he found the best moment to stand up to it.
I guess, it's a cute phrase, but it doesn't really seem to have the ferocity of the gloves-off neocon attacks, of which Gingrich is only the latest and maybe the most flamboyant, but there have been plenty, both operationally and rhetorically.
Well, I don't think Rumsfeld himself would never have said something like this, and neither can you expect Armitage or Powell to say something. I thought within the context of the fight, that was a very tough thing for Armitage to say. But I agree. I think it was Tom Gelton who said earlier that that President Bush really is more of a split-the-difference kind of guy than he is 100% on the side of Cheney and Rumsfeld, and that sometimes splitting the difference, by the way, doesn't work. He really pursued the Powell policy
up to a point, but seemed determined to go to war. And then Powell himself, I think, suffered a great blow when the French, from his point of view, kind of broke what he thought was a deal to keep pushing forward.
But if there is a critical moment,
it's that failure with the French, and whether you blame the French or you say Powell didn't see it coming, I think that was very important to his losing this round of the fight.
Jack Beatty, join us here on this split the difference issue, because this is crucial. Whether Colin Powell is a serious, genuine player at the table representing a point of view, a multilateral, much more traditional conservative worldview, that the president really takes seriously, or whether he's a kind of straw man who's out there to be repeatedly knocked down, and ultimately whether by design or by the president's own in his own psychiatric profile, whatever that may be, the neocons take the day, and Colin Powell is a flapjaw.
Well, I think there's a lot to that, that he's, Harry Belafonte, in a very cutting remark, said he called him, he said he's much like a house slave of President Bush's. Very cutting remark.
Yeah, he hated that remark,
too,
bitterly.
He hated that remark. But, you know, from Bush's side, you have to look at it. I mean, Powell's record of unsuccess has diminished his role. Last year, he said that we had no choice but to negotiate to deal with the chairman, Arafat. Bush said, nope, they got to get new leadership. And then we'll talk to them if they get leaders who disavow terrorism. Sure enough, Abu Mazen is inaugurated yesterday, and Bush's intransigence seemed to win. At the UN, the hawk said, "You go into the UN, you're going to get embarrassed. This isn't going to work. It'll just stymie us." Karl Powell said, "No, we got to go into the UN. He did get the one resolution, but in the end, it was a grave diplomatic debacle. And finally, with North Korea. Secretary Armitage, his deputy, went to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the senator said, should we deal directly with North Korea? Mm-hmm. As they ask, he said, yes, we'll have to. President Bush apparently went, quote, up the wall over that. He refused that. He said, no, we're going to deal with them multilaterally, talk to them multilaterally or not at all. Well, last week with the Koreans blinked, we talked to them multilaterally. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that, his advice hasn't been proven to be very successful.
EJ, and here's the roadmap, but as we heard at the top, they are from David Horowitz in Jerusalem. Not much enthusiasm in Israel, at least, for that. And clearly, by the bombing in Tel Aviv, as would be expected, there's still violent opposition in the Palestinian camp. Well, he may not resign, but as a point of principle, at some point, should he? Would it be the honorable thing to do?
Oh, I think there may well come a point when it's the honorable thing to do. The question is, if you're Powell and you assume you can still have some moderating influence on the Bush policy, because don't forget on that the Korean talks that Jack referred to, it was a sort of halfway house between multilateral and unilateral.
Yeah, just a little bit of China in there.
Together. That was a classic State Department solution, if ever there was one. And, it wouldn't surprise me if the administration is forced by events down a more Colin Powell road with North Korea, simply because there isn't a very good alternative. And I think in the case of the Middle East, the resigning point might come if it becomes extremely clear that despite the president's strong words today, he is not serious about engaging in these talks, doesn't seem like it's time. But I also think we can't overlook the fact that we act as if there is a kind of monolithic neocon view within the administration. And it wouldn't surprise me if there become to be some differences between Cheney and Rumsfeld, or a much more complicated fight about how we deal with Iraq now. And that I think that on the conservative side, there's going to be a split between neocons like Wolfowitz, who really want to stay the course there, keep our troops there for a long time to transform Iraq, and others who may well come to include Cheney and Rumsfeld, who say, well, let's get out of there as fast as we reasonably can, because this is going to be a mess that we don't want to be part of. And so I think you're going to have a new set of arguments where the lines might not be as neat as they looked in the period going into Iraq.
Interesting. Conservative monolithic front has been very strong on one side, but you're saying realities may come in and leverage some divisions right there. I want to welcome into our conversation Howard Means. He's a Colin Powell biographer, author of Colin Powell, Soldier, Statesman, Statesman, Soldier, former senior editor at the Washingtonian magazine, joining us tonight from Bethesda. Good evening and welcome, Howard Means.
How are you?
Very well. Howard, put us inside the mind of Colin Powell as far as you can tonight. He has taken an awful lot of abuse, some of it rhetorical, some of it very, very substantial, some of it right down to the roots of worldview, his being rebuked, being left in the ditch by this administration. How do you think he's taking this? He has such a cool demeanor. He knows he's got high public popularity, very high. But inside Colin Powell's private chambers, how is he processing this?
Oh, you know, he's not a moper. He's not a Hamlet. He's not a guy. You know, he's a guy basically that gets up every day determined to do his job. So I don't think that's going to discourage him. He's a fighter. And he's not going to be run out of town by basically a little rat dog performance like Newt Gingrich has been putting on. Third, he's a soldier through and through. And I think George Bush is his commander-in-chief. W. Bush is commander-in-chief. And it's better to wait until a natural break. One of your guests talked about the next Bush administration mm-hmm. that happens and the drop the dime now. And four, I think he's optimistic enough to believe that there are still plenty of world problems that could use a healthy dose of multilateral cooperation from North Korea to Palestine and beyond. So I think it's unlikely he's going to resign sort of in a huff.
Do you think he should?
Do I think he should? I think probably there's an argument that he should do it. I think he's lost. He gave it his best shot. The UN performance was classic Colin Powell. Overkill with the evidence, an appeal to reason, an appeal to decency and common cause.
And yet, where are the weapons, one might ask?
Yeah, exactly. You can argue he was sandbagged by his own people, but he gave it his best shot and failed.
Yep.
And if you look around him, the fault, your guests have been talking all about that. Rumsfeld, not Powell, defense, not state, making the calls in Iraq, et cetera. Rumsfeld and his cronies running all around Washington here, crowing about the fact, watch out Syria, watch out Iran, et cetera.
Yep.
It's all talk that just doesn't sit well with Colin Powell, I'm sure. My own guess is that the question is, what is he doing in the cabinet now? And as I look at it, he's basically providing camouflage for the president and particularly for the unilateralists on the right.
I mean, and meanwhile, the revolution goes on.
Yeah. I mean, so long as Colin Powell's in place, you got a lot of center-of-the-road Democrats and Republicans who can still delude themselves into thinking that a more world-centered view might ultimately prevail. And so long as he's there, you've got a world community that can pretend that the Bush administration is something it isn't, that it's not just, you can pretend it's beating its chest like some hormone-crazed teenager.
Well, Jay Garner said in Iraq Today, Americans should be beating their chest every day about their accomplishments.
Exactly. Of course, that's what they're all
his words.
Now. Yeah, that's not Colin Powell at all. Then if you take him out of the equation, I think people have to start looking at the state of, at what's really happening.
Howard Means, E.J. Dionne, stand by. A mountain of callers want to get in on this. I want to invite them in. Greg's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
Good. See, my question relates to what was just said here. Doesn't this administration run a great risk if it either gets rid of Colin Powell or says things eventually that force him to leave? Because I think there's a lot of people out there that are very uncomfortable with this unilateral ends-driven agenda, and they feel that Colin Powell, is this element of moderation in there, this element of reason that helps to, even the course A lot of people, I think, supported the war in Iraq because they felt that he had given it their best shot mm-hmm. rather than just rushing in guns blazing like some of the other people wanted to do months before.
Right. So it's a great question and a great point. E.J. Dionne, let me put it to you. And, Greg, thanks for your call. Is this a necessary, balance weight on the tire for this administration, E.J. Dionne? Can the Bush administration, can it flourish politically without the Colin Powell face on the backside of the Janus here?
Well, I think I agree with the caller that Powell is enormously helpful. He is the most popular. I mean, there was a poll done before the war asking Americans, I think it was a Gallup poll, whom do you trust on Iraq policy, Bush or Powell? And Powell beat Bush by a considerable margin, partly because he got all the Democrats and some of the independents. And I think Howard, the biographer, Howard, I've got your name right.
Howard
correct?
Means, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Howard Means, yes.
Talked about how people on the Hill deceive themselves with Powell. That could be one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that there is a powerful group of senators, Lugar, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Biden and Hagel, who are a kind of bipartisan core close to Powell's worldview. And I think there is some real cooperation between Powell and that part of Congress. And I think in the next phase of Iraq, it'll be, I think, somewhat easier for critics of the administration's, you know, of the kind of unilateralist line to have their voices heard, partly because Saddam Hussein is gone. The best card the administration always had to play is, well, how can you be soft on Saddam Hussein?
He's still out there.
He's a genuine bad guy, and he's out of power. Now the issues are very complicated about how are we going to run the place? Can we possibly run it alone? Is this not now the time to seek the allies that we didn't seek very hard in the first round? And this is where the Powell argument, I think, at least has a shot of gaining ground, not only on the outside, but perhaps even on the inside.
That, but that suggests a kind of peaking of the neocon impulse here, that that the Iraq war may be the top of it.
I think that's very possible, by the way.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, how do you read that?
Well, again, I want to return to North Korea. The Pentagon is redeploying our forces south of the DMZ. This is a sensitive issue with the South Koreans. And one of the reasons is because suddenly it's dawned on them, it's dawned on a lot of people, that if we want to strike the North Korean reactors in Yongbyon, we want those forces back from the DMZ so they won't be in harm's way.
So it makes war possible from an American perspective if you're looking at American lives.
Indeed it does. Now, Colin Powell doesn't want that. He wants to talk directly to the North Koreans. And he is in the situation of Secretary of State Bryan in 1915 when the issue was, shall you take a hard line toward Germany or not? And when he went, and when Bryan went to his last cabinet meeting, his colleague said, this will destroy you. And Bryan said, I believe it will, but my convictions won't permit me to do otherwise. I can't imagine Colin Powell so transcending his biography to say something like that.
Howard Means, is this, despite all the attributes, the positive attributes you list of Colin Powell, must he not at some level feel deeply dissed here?
Oh, of course he does. I think he does. I don't think there's any question about it. You know, Colin Powell said to me when I was doing my book that I asked him why they didn't go to Baghdad and, you know, in the first Gulf War, and he said he didn't want to do it because going there would involve us in 5,000 years of Mesopotamian history. And I think it has involved us. Now that we have gone, I think it has involved us. And I think what we were talking about earlier, I think it was EJ was talking about it, the denouement is still to be played out on all this. And I think it is possible that Powell's talents will be much more called for in the aftermath, and that he might have, you know, he might have a resurrection in within the administration.
Live to fight again. I guess it goes to this issue of whether or not you think that the neoconservative unilateral view peaked in Iraq or is just revving up for a whole lot more fights. There's language that would suggest both ways, but certainly no shortage of language that would say it's just revving up. We're talking tonight about Colin Powell and the deepening rift between the State Department and the Pentagon at the very heart of the Bush administration. Has Powell failed his own agenda? Does that mean he should go? Is it honest for the Bush administration to juggle two such opposing worldviews? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Secretary of State Colin Powell and the deepening rift between the State Department and the very powerful Pentagon, a rift at the very heart of the Bush administration. We're joined tonight by E.J. Dionne, columnist for The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, by Howard Means, Colin Powell biographer, author of Colin Powell, Soldier, Statesman, Statesman, Soldier, and our own Jack Beatty is in studio tonight as well. You can join us, too. What do you think? Is Colin Powell's moderation out of date? Is it old-fashioned? Whose school are you in, Cheney Rumsfeld's or Colin Powell's? And would the Bush White House, with its agenda, be better off, be more honest without Colin Powell? Should Colin Powell resign? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Art's calling from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Art. You're on the air.
Art, yes, thank you.
Sure.
I think Colin Powell should stay where he is for a while, but seriously consider bailing out of that administration. I believe he should have stayed where he is. And I'm not a Republican voter, but if we had to have, the nation wanted to have a Republican president, Colin Powell would have been the one. He chose not to. I understand that.
He did. He'd be your man, though. So you say stay in there or maybe go and run against President Bush. Art, thanks for your call. E.J. Dionne, what about it? Does Colin Powell have any political ambitions? Does he have political prospects?
I don't think he wants to run for president. I think a lot of Democrats would take a serious look at him at this point if he wanted their nomination, but that, I don't think that's going to happen. And I, just to go back to a point somebody made, you know, what is the strongest card Powell has to play besides his support in public opinion that this caller reflects is that he represents a very important wing of the Bush coalition, and that is President Bush, the first President Bush. And I think you could see throughout this that he really was speaking in many ways for the general orientation of the first President Bush on foreign policy.
The Jim Baker, the Brent Scowcroft school.
And the Baker-Scowcroft wing. And that,
but didn't they lose, E.J.? Didn't they just flat out lose?
I think they largely lost, although the strategy, they didn't lose entirely because we forget that Rumsfeld and Cheney really didn't want to go to the U.N. at all, which is why I say this is still more split the difference than a clear and overwhelming victory for what we're calling the neocon side. And I think this President Bush would be reluctant to make that kind of break and to completely break with his father's wing of the foreign policy.
Well, he surely doesn't want to send Colin Powell away, but the issue is whether he's really using him or not. Let's just for the heck of it, let's take Newt Gingrich's critique up here seriously for just a moment. I guess, EJ, you first. He says this State Department is a broken instrument of diplomacy, a broken instrument of international communications, a broken bureaucracy of red tape and excuses. On the merits, what do you make of the critique?
You know, a lot of it sounds like the critique of Dean Acheson and what did the Republicans call it, the cowardly school of communist containment, or sorry, the cowardly college of communist containment. I think there is, this is in a lot of ways a traditional conservative's critique of the State Department. And I think the argument, and Jack Beatty alluded to this, is did the diplomacy fail because the State Department and Colin Powell failed? And there were definitely some failures in there. Or did it primarily fail because the administration, the rest of the administration, wasn't really behind the effort? A friend of Powell's was quoted in either the New York Times or the Washington Post when we were all talking about duct tape, saying it would be a good security, good for our security if Donald Rumsfeld put duct tape on his lips. And I think that reflected the frustration of the Powell wing with what the other side was doing to their diplomacy.
Well, I mean, I really wonder about the split the difference. It seems to me that the message is, you hear it from Newt Gingrich, who knows who he speaks for, but you hear it from all kinds of cracks in the doorways in the Pentagon, that Colin Powell just doesn't get it. What is it in the neocon view that Colin Powell doesn't get, E.J. Dionne?
Well, first of all, Colin Powell wanted to stop the first war in Iraq when a lot of that side of the Republican Party wanted to keep it going. So it goes all the way back to there. And in fact, what they would argue is Colin Powell was reluctant to wage the first Gulf War in the first place. And so I think from then forward, there is a sense that Colin Powell is a cautious multilateralist, not an aggressive unilateralist. So there really is, you're right that there is a principal difference here. This isn't about personalities. This is about a real difference in worldview. And the one thing I'm quite convinced of is that Bush does not have as clear a worldview as some of the really strong neocons. I think he is still prepared to listen to some of these arguments for practical reasons, even though he's, as you say, he's leaned much more to the Rumsfeld side than to the other side.
Howard Means, does it look to you as though the unilateralists, maybe Dick Cheney, certainly Donald Rumsfeld, and a bunch of guys in his department, have rolled over Colin Powell? I mean,
they're taking their revenge, I think, in part for the first Gulf War.
For the failure to go to Baghdad the first time out.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the whole setup to the war. I mean, we delayed. We got 425,000, 450,000 people on the ground over there. Cheney wanted to go rushing off to Iraq, and Colin Powell won the first time around. He prevailed because what he was doing in the first Gulf War was representing, if you can call it the first Gulf War. Was representing the cumulative experience of Vietnam and all the lessons of Vietnam that his generation of officers, took in and they created what became known as the Weinberger or Powell Doctrine.
They won. They, you know, basically it was, you have overwhelming support on the ground. You have overwhelming public support back home.
But you know, Howard Means, our time is running down. I want to push this forward. I'm not sure we're fully letting breathe here.
Yeah.
Where we're leaning now, and it seems to me, you know, okay, the Gulf War happened first and second, but what we see emerging here is a very new, radically different foreign policy. It's even called American imperialism, and not abashedly very often. That seems to me a continent away from where Colin Powell began.
I couldn't agree more. And I think it's also, to go back to your previous question, it's not enough that for the Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz type of people, it's not enough that they win. The other person has to suffer in their defeat. And I think they're making him suffer right now.
Jack Beattie, I wonder about this, if it's not too easy to sort of imagine that what was will be, that moderation existed, it will exist again, but that, in fact, we're being moved onto a new train track here.
We may well be, and as you say, this doesn't comport with Powell's intellectual profile, so far as we get it. But, you know, Powell has had his own back, too. I mean, he's been fighting back through Bob Woodward now through two books.
Yeah,
and so...
Elaborate, Jack.
Well, Bob Woodward is his... It takes dictation from Colin Powell and then puts it between hide covers and sells a million copies.
His Cyrano de Bergerac
on
the bushes there.
Yeah, right. So, and what does he do there? He dishes every... You know, Rumsfeld is impetuous and foolish, and Powell gets all the good lines.
Yeah, so what? Netter, netter, netter.
He gets
and,
his
and
own
we went
back.
To war.
Right. That's true. That's true.
E.J. Dionne?
That's terrific.
No, I mean, he's, Jack is absolutely right. Colin Powell does have great capacity to get his story out. And, you know, I don't think winning the war I don't think Colin Powell ever said we couldn't win the war. I think the whole argument, and the reason why I think the argument is still open, was not whether we'd win the war, but what the peace would look like. And the argument for doing this more multilaterally with more allies is that the post-war period would have been easier. We wouldn't be there alone. We wouldn't have our own soldiers on the ground confronting these demonstrations almost all by themselves or sometimes with the British. And so I think that multilateralism is going to have its day in the logic of what we face for the next year, 2 years, or more in occupied Iraq. And I don't think we're going to decide that we want to do this job all by ourselves.
So you don't see Colin Powell as sort of out front, perhaps unintentionally, helping kind of perpetuate a fraud. We're moderate, we're neocon, we're moderate, we're neocon, but we always end up neocon.
I don't think anybody... I don't think there's a fraud here, because for the moment, I don't think there's any doubt that Bush has, on balance, chosen the Rumsfeld route. I think it's pretty clear. I think the issue is, if Powell loses every single fight for the next while, then we can be sure he won't serve in the second term, and then it will things will be very clear. I just think, I'd argue that the situation creates some openings for a view represented by people like Powell and Lugar and Hagel in the Republican Party, or a Biden in the Democratic Party, that they could win some fights now that they didn't win before the war.
And here's a soldier who is likely, in that case, to stick to his guns. E.J. Dionne, it's been great having you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to talk to Jack Beattie.
Great. E.J. Dionne is columnist for The Washington Post. And Howard Means, thank you so much for joining us from Bethesda tonight.
Thanks a lot.
Howard Means is Colin Powell biographer, author of Colin Powell, Soldier, Statesman, Statesman, Soldier. Well, Jack, so here it is. The notion that comes out of this is the neocons may have seen the interim height of their power.
Well, that's interesting. I would frankly like to see that. But, you know, our colleague Graham Griffith uses the image for Colin Powell of Alec Guinness in The Bridge on the River Kwai, building the bridges for his enemies.
And then kaboom.
And then kaboom.
Up it goes. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, Democratic Party leader Donna Brazile on the key to success in politics. This is On Point. Donna Brazile has been active in politics her whole life. As a child, she campaigned for a city councilor who promised to build a playground in her small Louisiana city. At age 21, she was the national student coordinator for the committee that successfully pushed for a Martin Luther King holiday. And in 2000, Brazile made history when Al Gore made her the first African-American woman to manage a presidential campaign. Brazil says the key to politics and any other endeavor is believing in your mission. In a speech at the Simmons School of Management's leadership conference this past weekend, Brazil shared her journey from the poverty of the Bayou to a major leadership role in American politics. Here are excerpts from her speech.
I have been involved in campaigns and politics since age 9. Perhaps my mother, that evening when Dr. King died, should have remained silent, but instead she told me to shut up and to sit down and to just watch the TV. I couldn't do that. I walked out the door that evening, went to a Baptist church, and for those of you who are Catholic, when you go to Baptist church, that's like committing 3 sins in one. And when I got home that night, I got the worst whipping of my life. It taught me one thing, and that is never, ever give up on something that you believe in. It also taught me to respect my mother and respect her wisdom, but it also led me to follow my dreams. And I knew growing up as a child in Louisiana that I wanted to follow my dream, to become active in the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the peace movement, the justice movement, any movement that would get me out of Kenner, Louisiana, as well as any movement that would enhance the life and the quality of life for young girls, especially poor children growing up in the Deep South. I've been involved in campaigns ever since that night back on April 4th, 1968. I've worked in campaigns that are very, very small with limited budgets. And as Reverend Jackson used to tell us when I worked for him, he said we had a huge campaign. And I would look at him and say, what do you mean by that? He said, we are a poor campaign, but we have a rich message. I also worked on campaigns that had lots of money, but no message, no motivation. And part of what I've tried to bring into the political process is a message, as well as that motivation that inspires people to get up from their seat and walk away and come back inspired to bring 10 other people into the room. It is important in politics, like business, like journalism and every other endeavor, that you believe in what you're doing, that you care about it, and that you are willing to make a difference. I'll tell this last story because I don't want my time to run out. When Mrs. King looked at me, I was a 21-year-old kid coming out of Louisiana. And she said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to know what you want to do, Mrs. King. And she said, well, I would like to make Martin's birthday a holiday. And I thought back to that whipping. And I said, boy, if I can make his birthday a holiday, I can call my mom and tell her I finally have a job. And along the way, people told us that it couldn't happen because the country had just gone conservative, elected a conservative president, Ronald Reagan, and a conservative Congress. And they said there was no way the conservatives in Congress, and we kept saying, what do we have to lose? We believe in this. We want this to happen. A bunch of kids like myself, we went out there and we got over 7 million signatures. And God bless his soul, Tip O'Neill was there that day when we walked up to the Capitol and said, this is what I need. I need the voices of the people. And we looked at him, we said, you have enough? We need more? We were hungry. He said, no, this is all I need. They passed it in the House, we got it through the Senate, and we have a holiday in honor of a man who gave his life for freedom, for justice and equality.
Donna Brazile was campaign manager for Al Gore in the 2000 election. She is currently the national chair of the Voting Rights Institute, the Democratic Party's initiative to promote the right to vote. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.